This was our decision and our decision alone to ensure that our assets and our employees are really prepared to work in the Arctic in the future.
Shell suspends its Arctic drilling program for 2013. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, chasing down winter storms where they form off the coast of Alaska to improve forecasting.
What's going on in the lower 48 starts up here in the North Pacific.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
With both of Shell Oil's Arctic drill rigs headed to dry dock for repairs, the company says it's suspending its 2013 drilling season. Spokesman Curtis Smith says the New Year's Eve grounding of the Kulluk drill rig prompted the company to reassess its plans.
This was our decision, and our decision alone, based on, among other things, our strong desire to incorporate learnings from 2012 operations and to ensure that our assets and our employees are really prepared to work again in the Arctic in the future.
Last year's drilling season was plagued with problems. The company couldn't get its oil spill containment barge certified. Then the Noble Discoverer nearly ran aground in Unalaska. And the year ended with the grounding of the Kulluk in shallow offshore waters near Kodiak. But Shell did drill the beginnings of two exploratory wells in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, and it plans to finish those in the future. Alaska's congressional delegation hailed the decision to suspend operations as a sign that the company is committed to safety. Environmental groups also praised the decision, but interpreted it differently. Michael Levine is senior counsel for the ocean conservation group Oceana.
This announcement, while it comes as no surprise, reflects a crisis of confidence for the company and the government agencies charged with regulating it.
The Coast Guard, the Department of the Interior, and the Justice Department are all investigating aspects of Shell's Arctic operations, but Levine called for them to go further.
The government must take this opportunity to reassess the standards that govern the decisions it makes about our Arctic Ocean resources, the way it makes those decisions, and its oversight of multinational companies that are beholden to their bottom lines and have shown clearly that they are incapable of operating with the care Alaskan waters deserve.
Shell will continue to do scientific research in the Arctic this summer and may also try to do some prep work at its drill sites. In the meantime, Shell is focused on getting its damaged rigs to dry dock in Asia. The Kulluk started retracing its route back to Unalaska yesterday. Shell hopes to complete the 800-mile journey in less than 10 days, although that's dependent on weather. From Unalaska, the massive drill rig will be loaded onto an even more massive heavy lift vessel. That ship will take the Kulluk to dry dock in Asia for repairs. This month has been a busy one for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Winter Storms Reconnaissance Project. The agency tracks developing winter storms in the North Pacific with an airplane equipped to eject data-gathering instruments into the atmosphere. That data is quickly fed into weather models to help refine the forecasts for potentially damaging storms that will hit Alaska and the lower 48. APRN's Annie Feit went along on a flight last week and has this report.
On land, meteorologists use weather balloons to get information from inside a developing storm. But there's nowhere to launch a balloon in the vast area between Alaska and Hawaii in the North Pacific. So electrical engineer John Hill is getting ready to drop a white tube called a drop sond out the back of the airplane.
So I'm going to take the tape off so the ribbon will unravel.
This is the second drop sond Hill is sending off the flight. The instruments inside it will gather data on temperature, wind direction, humidity, and pressure on their way to the ocean. After unraveling the parachute ribbon, Hill pulls a red tab to turn the power on, and it's ready to go. He slides it into a portal and clicks the lid shut.
Stick it in the tube, that's it.
5 minutes later, Hill pushes a lever and sends the contraption shooting out the bottom of the airplane.
So there it went?
There it went. And the data starts coming in. You can see the altitude. You can see the pressure. The air temperature outside is about minus 45.
Along the 3,000-mile flight route on this day, Hill sends 16 dropsondes floating down into a remote section of ocean south of Alaska. The plane flies as high as 45,000 feet to allow for as much data as possible to be collected through different levels of the atmosphere. Once the $600 contraptions reach the ocean, their job is done. In the front of the plane, meteorologist and flight director Ian Sears can see the data as it starts rolling in as colorful plot points on his computer screen.
What's going on in the lower 48 starts up here in the North Pacific.
The data will help forecasters more accurately predict the track of a storm and its intensity. Sears describes it this way.
The atmosphere is kind of like a pond without any wind on it. Very still. And if you throw a rock in the middle of that pond, you're going to have ripples that go out from where the rock was thrown in. And what we're doing is we're seeing how big that rock was. And these waves that are generated up here in the North Pacific are going to move east and southeast into the lower 48.
It takes Sears about 15 minutes to process the 900 lines of data each dropson generates into a more digestible form. He sends it off the airplane by sat phone as quickly as possible so it can be plugged immediately into weather forecast models. Sears says forecasters can do their job without the extra data, but they have to do a lot more guesswork.
Well, there becomes a lot of uncertainty for the forecasters, where one global model might suggest that the storm is going to be over Chicago, where the next model suggests it might be going to the Arkansas region. There's a lot of uncertainty there. And if we can narrow those uncertainties down, that's where the forecaster has more confidence in what it is he's looking at in the models, and hopefully can provide a good forecast to the public.
And it doesn't take long for Sears to see the data start to do its job. 2 weeks ago, the crew flew several days to help refine the forecast for a big snowstorm that eventually walloped Kansas City last week. Sears says before they started flying, the models were predicting a weaker storm that would track farther north. Chief scientist and engineer Alan Goldstein has been flying winter storm missions for NOAA since they first started 15 years ago. He says the project is an expensive one, about $1 million for 2 months this winter, but very worthwhile.
If you can give the people in Chicago or New York or in Kansas City a better 3 to 5 day forecast, it lets them prepare, lets the people go out and buy the groceries they have to, lets the civil defense folks gear up, and that's really important, and it's important for the economy, and it saves lives.
The NOAA plane, which is affectionately called Gonzo, will be based out of Hawaii until March 10th. It's flying missions out of Anchorage and Honolulu, depending on where in the North Pacific the big storms are forming. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska's redistricting board is awaiting the outcome of a United States Supreme Court case that could remove some federal restrictions from state redistricting plans. Today, the nation's highest court heard arguments over whether the states with a history of discrimination need to get Department of Justice approval for state voting maps. Although the federal Supreme Court case was brought by an Alabama county, it has implications for Alaska. The state of Alaska filed a brief in support of the plaintiffs, while the Alaska Federation of Natives filed a brief in support of the federal government. Alaska's redistricting board is wrestling with a state Supreme Court mandate to redraw the state's voting districts map. Board attorney Mike White says last year, the districts were drawn to comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act, but the state Supreme Court justices said the process the board used was not in line with the state constitution.
The board has to have in place a new plan prior to June of 2014. I believe it is the board's wants to get this matter done and approved by the Alaska Supreme Court. And the board hasn't formally adopted anything. It's still considering what its options are and determining how it wants to proceed.
The outcome of the U.S. Supreme Court case could affect the redrawing of the Alaska voting map, White says, because Alaska is one of nine states that is required by law to comply with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
If Section 5 or parts of it are thrown out by the United States Supreme Court, that could affect how the Alaska redistricting map is drawn. Basically, what it does is it changes the rules that the Alaska Redistricting Board must follow. And if the rules change, then that could change the outcome.
White says he does not expect a decision in the federal case anytime soon. The Federal Voting Rights Act ensures that minorities have representation in House districts. Regardless of the ruling in the federal case, Alaska would still have to comply with other parts of the VRA, which protect the percentage of minorities of voting age in voting districts. In a separate action, the state of Alaska challenged Section 5 of the VRA last year, arguing that the requirement is unwarranted and Alaska should not be considered among states where voting discrimination has been flagrant. That case is on hold as well, pending the outcome of the Alabama case. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, recognizing Alaska's most accomplished women with a Hall of Fame.
How do we make sure that we find the women who actually made a difference statewide or impacted the nation from Alaska?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give, and good things will happen for the causes you care about. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust and BP Alaska.
Alaska's Medicaid program pays for a few hundred abortions each year, and some state lawmakers think that number is too high. At a hearing today, the Senate Judiciary Committee considered a bill that provides a strict definition of the term medically necessary. They consulted with a trio of doctors affiliated with the anti-abortion movement on where the line should be drawn and outraged many Democrats in the process. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Epilepsy, eclampsia, pulmonary hypertension, and sickle cell anemia. Those are all conditions where a low-income woman would still qualify for abortion coverage under a new bill being considered by the Alaska State Legislature. But depression, schizophrenia, alcohol dependence, and bulimia aren't on the list, nor are any other mental health conditions. The three medical professionals invited to testify at the bill's first hearing laid out their case for why only conditions that endanger a woman's physical health should be covered by Medicaid. Priscilla Coleman, a psychologist whose research focuses on abortion and depression, called in from Ohio.
I can say with a reasonable degree of scientific and medical certainty that abortion is a substantial contributing factor in women's mental health problems. Abortion is a particularly risky choice for women with pre-existing mental illness.
Coleman explained that her studies had shown that abortion can correlate with future depression and substance abuse, and for that reason, an abortion on mental health grounds should not qualify for state funding. But Coleman's research has come under scrutiny from inside Alaska and beyond. The chair of the Alaska Democratic Party described her and the other doctors invited to testify as extremists, and the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has previously called Coleman's research unreliable. The American Psychological Association has also found fault with her research linking abortion and mental health issues. Senator Bill Willikowski, the lone Democrat on the committee, questioned her on that point.
And I'll quote the headline study regarding your article, study purporting to show link between abortion and mental health outcomes decisively debunked. Did they issue a statement?
Yeah, I
to that
think
effect?
You're referring to a different study. That was not related to the meta-analysis.
The other two doctors invited to testify were also supportive of the bill. John Thorpe, an obstetrician from North Carolina, said that only in cases of extreme hemorrhaging should an abortion be viewed as medically necessary. Susan Rutherford, an obstetrician from Washington, provided the committee with a couple of other physical conditions that should be included in the bill, but also rejected the idea of a mental health allowance. Both are members of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Senator John Coghill, who chairs the Judiciary Committee and is the lead sponsor of the bill, said he invited the group to testify to get a medical perspective on the bill since it wasn't going through the Senate's Health and Social Services Committee. He also said that he found the work conducted by the testifiers to be credible. During the hearing, most of the committee members seemed receptive to the bill, with three of the five members already having signed on as co-sponsors. But Democrat Wilikowski questioned the need for the bill. During the hearing, legislative aide Chad Hutchinson stated that the bill was necessary because its supporters had reason to believe that Medicaid is currently covering elective procedures. Wilikowski pushed him to identify a case where an abortion that was not medically necessary had been funded.
Do you have any evidence of any abortions in the state of Alaska that have been paid for by Medicaid that were elective as opposed to being medically necessary?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I believe the statistics that we quoted show that is occurring.
Hutchinson elaborated that Medicaid covers a third of abortions in the state, and that data from the Guttmacher Institute suggested that a much smaller percentage of abortions performed nationally were done out of medical necessity. Testimony on the bill continues next week when Planned Parenthood is invited to testify. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Most rural Alaska communities use diesel generators to create electrical power, but fuel is expensive, so they're trying out alternatives. Yakutat on the eastern Gulf of Alaska wants wave power. A project in the works for several years just won a key permit, but it still faces substantial barriers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
How big are those waves in Yakutat? Just ask a surfer.
Just awesome. That's beautiful.
Enthusiasts from around the world have traveled to Yakutat's remote beaches to catch a wave in wetsuits. Now the community, hundreds of miles away from the nearest grid, wants to make another use of that power.
If we're able to convert that energy that's pounding onto our shores and displace diesel, the state's going to save a lot of money.
Chris Rose is the founder and executive director of REAP, the Renewable Alaska Energy Project.
We're a place that makes sense to test this stuff because we have higher energy costs than a lot of other places.
The bottom line is we have to get away from diesel.
Skip Ryman is manager of the Yakutat Borough, about halfway between Juneau and Cordova. He says the municipal power plant sells electricity for about 57 cents a kilowatt hour. The state's power cost equalization program halves the residential price, but still,
people are finding that anywhere from 45 to 60% of their disposable income has been going for utilities and home heating. This, in turn, is hurting retailers. We've been losing families, losing kids in the school system, and essentially just sending the community into a bit of a death spiral.
Yakutat has been interested in wave energy for some time. A study completed about 4 years ago recommended a system installed near the shore rather than farther out into the ocean.
The device that we're working on is called a oscillating waves surge converter.
Cliff Gowdy is senior engineer for Massachusetts-based Resolute Marine Energy.
That's sort of a fancy word for a paddle that sits on the bottom, that's hinged at the bottom, the hinge being parallel to the shoreline. And so as the surge of the waves pass over the top, the paddle gets pushed towards the beach and then back and forth.
The company is working with federal, state, and local officials to research and fund the Yakutat project. It will use Resolute's surge wave energy converter, which uses hydraulic pumps to power a generator. The device has been tested off the North Carolina coast, but it doesn't have a track record. Neither does its competitors.
In terms of commercial arrays of wave energy devices, they currently don't exist anywhere in the world.
Oregon State University's Belinda Batten is director of the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center. She says Scotland has taken the lead, testing a number of different devices and systems at a major research facility.
Until we really get the sort of small arrays of devices in and producing energy over some time where we learn operating and maintenance costs, reliability, sustainability, and those kinds of things, it'll be tough to call the winners.
Resolute Marine Energy was recently granted a preliminary permit allowing more research and planning, but it still must clear other regulatory hurdles. The company and its partners also need to address environmental impacts and conflicts with other users of the area. There's the surfers, of course. Borough Manager Ryman says that's not all.
It is an area used by trawlers. You have whale migration offshore. There's some concern about the noise these might be making and how that might interfere with whale migrations.
An Oregon wave energy proposal has drawn opposition from crabbers and recreational boaters. Yakutat's project is being designed to meet the community's power needs for much of the year. Ryman says diesel generators would fill the gap when needed, especially when the local fish processor operates. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Tomorrow evening, 15 women will be inducted into the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame in a ceremony in Anchorage. The recognition of women's contributions to the state started in 2008 during the 50th anniversary of statehood. Former Anchorage Assembly Chair and prior year inductee Jane Anvik is on the steering committee. She says women from several service organizations decided the statehood celebration was a good time to honor great Alaskan women.
How do we make sure that we find the women who have made a difference in Alaska in any field, in any community activities, in or who actually made a difference statewide or impacted the nation from Alaska?
This is the fifth year of recognizing those contributions. There are 15 women being inducted tomorrow evening, bringing the total to 110. One of the inductees is Judge Karen Hunt. Judge Hunt was the first female Superior Court judge appointed in Anchorage in 1984. She was a teacher in Los Angeles schools, but decided to go to law school in the 60s. She says things have changed dramatically from the time when the big issue was whether women could work in a private firm.
Pretty much the federal government was hiring, the state government was hiring. And so the entree for many women into the practice of law was into government agencies. But trying to get a job in a private firm in which you would face the responsibility of meeting face-to-face with clients was a hurdle that women lawyers are having trouble getting over.
Judge Hunt was appointed by Governor Bill Sheffield. After years of being a trial attorney, she says the first day she entered court as a judge and everyone stood up, she turned around to see who was behind her and then, embarrassed, realized she was the reason they were standing. She says being inducted into the Hall of Fame is humbling.
I have a little trouble thinking that I belong in that group, but I have to tell you that I'm extraordinarily pleased to have been considered and included. It's quite humbling.
Marie Nash is another inductee this year. She is of Aleut and Japanese descent and was born in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. After college, Nash first worked for Alaska Congressman Howard Pollack. She went on to spend 20 years working for Senator Ted Stevens. Nash also served on the Bristol Bay Native Association Board for more than a decade. From her early beginnings as an American whose rights were stripped because of her heritage to working for a powerful U.S. senator, Marie Nash is happy to be inducted.
Well, I was surprised and, like Judge Hunt, very humbled.
The Alaska Women's Hall of Fame induction ceremony is tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. at the Wilda Marston Theater in the Lusac Library in Anchorage. More is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Bikers obliterated a previous course record in this year's Iditarod Trail Invitational. The first riders pedaled across the finish line this morning to complete the 350-mile race between Kinnick and McGrath. Four of the race's top five finishers this year are all cyclists from Alaska. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
Jay Peterberry beat out three competitive rookies and one very experienced veteran to win this year's Iditarod Trail Invitational. This is Peterberry's sixth ITI and his first win.
I didn't sleep at all.
And I didn't spend, I don't think I spent an hour at any checkpoint.
There are six checkpoints along the 350-mile trail between Kinnick and McGrath. Peter Vary says good trail conditions and warm weather had a lot to do with his record-breaking performance. He won the race in 2 days, 19 hours, and 16 minutes, shaving nearly 10 hours from a previous course record set in 2007. But he says neither winning nor setting the record were part of his plan.
I think when it comes to the Iditarod Trail Invitational, you can't really make a plan. You just have to come prepared. So I don't like to try to say that I'm going for the win or I'm going for the record when I know there's so many variables, weather being the biggest one, that could change the whole event.
Seven-time finisher and 2009 champion Jeff Oatley of Fairbanks tied training partner and rookie Kevin Breitenbach for third place behind Anchorage biker Tim Bernston. All three men pedaled across the line less than an hour behind Peter Vary. Jeff Oatley says this year's race wasn't like any of his others.
Normally, the race starts off pretty easy and gets harder as you go. And this was the opposite, like because of the snow conditions, getting up the Yentna and to Finger Lake was a real grind. We were really burning a lot of energy. But then from Huntilla to Rainy Pass was unbelievable. It was dead calm, nice weather, comfortable temperatures, and a great trail. We were riding almost all the way up the pass.
The race ends in McGrath at the home of Berlin native Peter Schneiderheinze. He cooks an enormous breakfast for athletes who are completing the 350-mile race or continuing on the 1,000-mile journey to Nome.
I used to be a racer myself, not that kind of extreme racer, but I mean, those guys impressed me. They're bike racers too, you know.
Schneiderheinze's menu includes something called a man cake, which even race organizer Bill Merchant can't really describe.
A man cake is way too much to be called a pancake. They're about an inch and a half thick, full of blueberries and cranberries. And now, I have seen some girl racers devour two man cakes like it was nothing, so it has nothing to do with real gender, you know.
29 bikers and 19 runners signed up to compete in this year's ITI. Only 12 of them are planning to push on for Nome. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.